This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Lisa Beck is one of two new Democratic state representatives here in Northwest Indiana, in Lake County in particular. She's out of Hebron, and of course the other is from out of Northwest Indiana as well. But she and her colleague, Chris Chung, will be going down to the State House to become new state representatives. Lisa is the new state representative in District 19. She beat incumbent Republican Julie Althoff, and she is joining us today to talk about the experience of running against an incumbent as well as winning, and your experience in Organization Day, which just wrapped up yesterday. Lisa Beck, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, first, let's recap your campaign. Tell us about how things went, as well as about the issues that you brought up during the campaign that they got you elected.
Well, we started our campaign we announced October 10th of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And I started actually going door-to-door, talking to folks in November of 2017. So I really realized pretty quickly, I had never campaigned for myself before. This is the first time that I ever ran for office. So I probably was a little rusty in the beginning because I had previously campaigned for other people. But what I realized is when you are the candidate that it's really more important that I listen to people. And so, you know, you asked what were the issues that I campaigned on.
Yeah.
I quickly found out that what people care about mostly is infrastructure, good infrastructure, for many reasons. People talk to me about, you know, that we need good roads, just, you know, not only for safety, but also because we want to attract businesses here. We also talked about people were concerned about the tolls. You know, the toll road right now is, of course, in Northwest Indiana, as well as across the whole north part of the state, but the money isn't necessarily spent here. It's spent all over the state. And I think people are concerned about that, especially when you have the prospect of Klein Avenue being a toll bridge, as well as a toll road, I should say. And there's a study right now being done for I-65 to be a toll road. Most people were really concerned about I-65 only because we don't have a lot of infrastructure, a lot of other fairways that take us that would be comparable to I-65, so we, as living here, would be told as well. So that was one of the issues. The next thing was education. I think a lot of people are really concerned about the funding formula for schools. You know, we had in both Hobart and Crown Point a referendum last year. Hobart's, of course, was in the fall of 2017, and Crown Point had theirs in the spring of 2018. I think a lot of people are concerned about, from what they've told me, that, you know, that we make sure we have proper funding. I mean, all the school systems in District 19 are really good schools, and we want to keep them that way. The last thing that people talked to me about was good-paying jobs. There are jobs out there, but I think what folks are looking for is, you know, good-paying jobs. A lot of people are working more than one job in order to provide for their families. So, you know, I think our campaign was really about talking to folks in House District 19 and, you know, finding out what are the things that most people care about.
When you put all this together, all the issues that you put together and had a chance to talk with constituents about here prior to the election, and of course we know the outcome of the election, that you've now become a state representative in District 19. You had a chance to make a visit to the State House for Organization Day this week. Have you been down to Indianapolis to the State House in the past?
Well, I have been down. Earlier we talked, and I had mentioned that last year I went down for the ISTA, Indiana State Teachers Association, had a lobby day. And then I also went down for the American Cancer Association had a lobby day. So the Relay for Life in Crown Point is, I believe, they're rated number two this year.
Uh-huh.
They do a fabulous job, and so I went down with some of those folks. And, yeah, so I got to see what lobby day was like. Prior to that, I think the only time I'd ever been in the State House, if I can remember, was I think when my kids were in in elementary school. We went in fourth grade.
Well, you're probably either a chaperone or you're an advisor, right, or somebody going down for the tour to the state house. A little different when you have a bunch of young people that you're chaperoning around and making sure that they don't get lost. You can get lost very easily in that big building. So you had at least a passing familiarity with the state house. How was it on organization day when you had a chance to go in there and actually realize this is the place I'm going to be spending an awful lot of my time, certainly in the first 3 or 4 months of the new year coming up?
I think it's pretty awe-inspiring just to be in that room. And, you know, there's a lot of really important people that were there. And I think, you know, people that we read about in the newspaper, you know, where I'm sitting in the room where things that we read about happen. So that was pretty amazing. I think that there was, there's a lot of excitement this year, I think, because, as you know, Chris Chung also went down to the state house. He won his election. And Pat Boy is somebody also that's from the region that went down. So I think there's a lot of excitement about us. And then Chris Campbell, who's from West Lafayette, is also going down. And there's a lot of excitement. Hopefully, you know, some of the things that people hear about, you know, we'll get into some issues that, or at least make some changes that will be important to people, not only here but across the state,
mm-hmm.
I hope.
Okay. You had a chance, of course, experience, of course, being sworn into office by the Indiana Supreme Court Chief Justice Loretta Rush, who, of course, was a resident of Munster when she was a child, and had a chance to, of course, grow up for a while in Northwest Indiana, then finally practice law down in Lafayette and other places, too. I understand you had an interesting conversation with Chief Justice Rush when you had a chance to meet her earlier. How did things go on Organization Day?
Well, I actually walked up to her because when she was sworn in, we had the women lawyers from Northwest Indiana, we had an event for her, and it was very well attended. It was a really awesome evening. It was at the Radisson. I don't even remember what year that was, to be honest with you. I had to look it up.
Mm-hmm.
But since then, the women lawyers, there's other women lawyer groups in the state. Last year, the Chief Justice invited women to her home, the women lawyers to her home in West Lafayette. So at that meeting, she had said, you know, we need to have more women legislators. I knew at that time that I was thinking about running. So I never said anything to her. I mean, this was a room full of a lot of people. But yesterday I did walk up to her and I introduced myself. She said she remembered me. I hope she did. And she said, when I told her that I was recently elected, that I was from Lake County, she said, you know, oh, my gosh. And actually, I reminded her of being at her house last year. So it was kind of neat. That was pretty neat.
Well, see, you're making the transition here now, obviously, from being a housewife and an attorney as well, to now becoming a state representative. Had a chance to experience Organization Day with a lot of other people in both the Indiana House and the Senate, of course, although you were in the House chambers for most of your time, I'm sure. But what'd you think about the crowd showing up there on Organization Day?
It was pretty amazing. There's a lot of people, a lot of family members and friends, a lot of supporters. You know, I don't think any one campaign or any one candidate got there on their own. So there were a lot of people that were really excited to be there and to see whoever they supported be there. That was pretty amazing. I know there was also a group that was outside protesting about gerrymandering, redistricting reform.
Yeah.
I don't know if you were aware of that, but
oh yes, in fact, we've had some of the authors of the conversations here on Regionally Speaking talking about the importance for redistricting reform, and among them Julia Vaughn from Common Cause, who's one of the chief statewide advocate for it. Yeah, so she's out there, and I'm sure that they are going to be lobbying very hard in the upcoming session to make sure that lawmakers are aware of the issue if they're not already aware, and maybe take some action on it to be sure. We know that one of the important things, probably the most important thing that you'll get to experience in your first session in the General Assembly coming up in January is helping your colleagues figure out and pass a new 2-year state budget. That's going to probably be one of the keys of, I'm sure, a very serious contention between Democrats, new ones like yourself, and the veteran lawmakers, including the Republicans and the Democrats that are already in the House. What do you feel about the issues that you're going to face? And a lot of this, I know, will come back to what you've campaigned for, what you'd like to see, if possible, enacted in the next budget for the next 2 years.
Well, yesterday the leader of the House, Brian Bosma was elected. And, you know, when he gave his speech, one of the things that he mentioned was teacher raises, which I'm sure you know that Senator Eddie Melton has a bill that he hopes to get through that would allow for raises for teachers. They haven't had a raise in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of studies done that show that, you know, we really, teacher pay, and I can't remember exactly because there's been a couple different studies, but they're not making any more money than what they were 10 years ago, which is, you know, not good. So I think that what the leader had said yesterday was that he, it sounds like he is in favor of that. So that's very exciting. You know, and he also talked about having the profession. I think that we've seen so many things with teachers having to use their own money to pay for supplies in the classroom. And there's been, it's difficult to find teachers in today's world because, you know, not only is teacher pay low, but also the enthusiasm because some of the changes that have been made have, teachers have not been involved in the decision-making process. So there's a lot of folks that maybe were thinking about being teachers or not being teachers are not going into the profession today. So he did mention something about bringing back the respect, you know, of being a teacher. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, was fabulous.
Are there any other issues that the speaker, Bosma, talked about, or you and your other colleagues, new colleagues, and the veterans have talked about here as to what may also come up in the legislative session this time around? You mentioned Senator Melton wanting to help put a measure through that would boost teachers' pay, to be sure. Are there any other measures that you feel that you would like to maybe, if not sponsor, at least you'd like to co-sponsor with your other colleagues?
I think at this point, to be honest with you, I'm not really sure what... you know, what I'm going to be looking at, I am going to spend a lot of time looking at some of the bills that are being proposed. I from what they told me on December 10th, those will be available. So, you know, I at this time, I'm not really sure what I'm going to dig into. But I've not been assigned to my committee. What I'm hoping to get on is the Labor Committee.
Mm-hmm.
I also asked to be on a committee for... the criminal code and courts. You know, just because of my background, I thought that would be something that would be beneficial. Small business and economic development.
Well, you mentioned a couple of points there. You mentioned the committees that you'd like to be on, labor and involved in economic development. You talked, too, about going back to your campaign topics, talking about wanting to make sure that Northwest Indiana has more jobs, better jobs, and better-paying jobs, to be sure. You think that there might be some efforts, if there are any bills that come up in the session, that'll pique your attention?
I'm not aware of anything right now. I talked to some folks that were related to labor yesterday. That is something that I'm looking into. There was an issue that was brought up, and I think it was in the papers recently, that Indiana is doing very well when it comes to corporate tax. But during the orientation, it was very powerful. We were shown a slide that talked about, you know, Indiana has gotten rid of the inheritance tax, so we no longer have any income from inheritance tax. We also have, since 2012, our corporate tax rate has decreased. So last year, at the end of the year, we actually paid out more in corporate tax refunds than we received in corporate taxes. So I think, you know, this graph showed the corporate tax rate going down to where we're not really, our state is really running off of personal income tax and sales tax. So I think that's a real problem. I think the policy that lowering the corporate tax rate will draw businesses here is just really not enough. I think we need good infrastructure. And we need some of the other quality of life measures that we don't have here.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, Lisa. So, let me ask you, Lisa Beck. Now that you're now a state representative elect, but you will become one. You've now been sworn in as one, to be sure. But you get the opportunity now to not only represent your district up here, District 19 here in Lake County, and parts of Porter County as well. when you have this chance to go down to Indianapolis for the legislative session in January, you probably got some other things if you haven't worked out yet that you know you have to do some housekeeping matters about finding some place to stay when you're down there during the week during the legislative sessions. You figure you'll be back home, I think, as often as you can, obviously, to meet with people and to be back with the family and take care of business back home in Hebron. But you're also going to have to deal with the business down there when you're at the State House. Have you had a chance to go down and check out places or talk to other people where you might be able to spend some time, at least to get together when you all are down at the State House during the week?
You know what we do have? I'm very happy. Pat Boy, who is also going down, like I said, from Michigan City, I think she and I are going to share a condo.
Well, great. I've heard that from a lot of people, even from people that you wouldn't necessarily think would have to look for roommates. They will do so because it's a way to keep your expenses low and still be down there when you have to be down there, especially in the winter months in January when it never seems to stop snowing in central Indiana, which we know is the case up here in northwest Indiana, too. So you can't say that you're not familiar with that. And also, too, you have this opportunity, if you haven't already, to experience what traffic in downtown Indianapolis is like. You've had your chance to visit just on occasion before, but knowing that you're going to have the trip down I-65 all the time, at least down until you go down to stay for the week or whatever, what are your thoughts about traveling around the State House and around Indianapolis right now?
I guess I'll just do the best I can.
I think even the veteran lawmakers would tell you that as well too. They have to deal with it too. And there are many state lawmakers I know I've talked to in the past that have said that they're glad they're retiring because they don't have to make that trip down I-65. But they do it knowing that they've enjoyed the trip over time, and it just seems very, very tedious. And that's part of the being a responsible citizen legislator, I guess. So you're going to have an opportunity to be experienced in Indianapolis as well as up here in northwest Indiana. Are you still excited about the prospect of going down to start your first legislative session in January?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I definitely am very excited. I mean, one of the things that the leader suggested yesterday was to read the rules and make sure you have the rules down. So I do plan to spend the next month reading the rules and looking over some of the bills that have already been submitted and, you know, looking for something that's of interest to me based on, you know, what I believe our community wants. So, yeah, I'm going to be busy in December, I think.
I think it seems that way, too. Well, Lisa Beck, thank you very much for spending some time with us to talk today as you've come back from Indianapolis for Organization Day at the General Assembly and getting ready as the new state representative in District 19 here in Lake County and parts of Porter County, ready to represent your constituents as one of the new Democrats on the roster at the State House. And we appreciate you spending time to talk with us and wish you the best of luck as you're making your trek down I-65 into downtown Indianapolis. And getting yourself accustomed to staying in Indy and as well staying at the State House, too. Thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you, Chris. And like I said, I really appreciate the opportunity for this, but also the opportunity to go down there and to, you know, work for the folks in House District 19.
Lisa Beck, who's the new state representative for District 19 here in northwest Indiana. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, supported by South Shore Clean Cities. And in for Carl Lissick, here's Lori.
Well, thank you for that introduction. This is Lori Cagle in for Carl Lissick. And today our guest is John Sherrington, Executive Director of Sales and Marketing for Renewable Energy Group. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Lori. Appreciate it.
Please tell us more about Renewable Energy Group.
Yeah, Renewable Energy Group, or REG, is the nation's largest producer and marketer of biodiesel. Our headquarters is in Ames, Iowa. We've got 11 biodiesel refineries located across the country. Those are mainly located in the Midwest. We've been marketing biodiesel a long, long time, all the way back to 1996.
Wow.
And we sell neat, pure B100 biodiesel, or we also sell biodiesel blends B5 to B20. Mm-hmm. And the product is currently readily available throughout Indiana.
Great. Are you starting to see some increased interest from public and private fleets to use biodiesel?
Yeah, Lori, we are both in the public and the private sector, and I think there's a few reasons for that. The first of which is just increased product availability of biodiesel. It's become a mainstream fuel. Nearly 3 billion gallons of biodiesel was integrated into the distillate fuel supply chain in 2017. We expect that to grow in 2018.
That's great.
And once again, it's readily available throughout Indiana and the greater Chicagoland area. I think a second reason is there just tends to be, both in the public and the private sector, a lot more interest in low carbon emissions fuels. In particular, a growing number of public and private entities have corporate sustainability initiatives that biodiesel can help them meet. And then finally, just the economics work. Typically, biodiesel is at a par or perhaps even a few cents a gallon cheaper than diesel fuel.
Sure. All good points. John, are there performance advantages associated with utilizing biodiesel blends as well?
Yeah, the product quality of biodiesel being produced today is absolutely exceptional. So some of the benefits include, you know, reduced tailpipe emissions as well as reduced greenhouse gas emissions. Biodiesel at very low blends, just B2 and higher, is a tremendous lubricity additive to diesel fuel. There's no requirement to add outside additives if you're utilizing biodiesel. Mm-hmm. And then finally, biodiesel has enhanced cetane levels, which helps engines perform better. It's a lot like octane in gasoline. So those are some of the performance attributes of biodiesel.
Great. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Lori Cagle in this week for Carl Lissick. John, what about cold weather performance for biodiesel? How does it work?
Yeah, so our customers these days, Lori, are using biodiesel year-round. Biodiesel, just like diesel fuel, does need to be managed, you know, in some of the harsh climates we have in the wintertime. So we have lots of customers that will use B15 to B20 blends mm-hmm. of biodiesel in the summertime. In the wintertime, they will back that off to B5 or B11 blends. And in some cases, they'll add either kerosene or number one diesel fuel or additives to that. But customers today are successfully utilizing biodiesel year-round across the country.
Great. That's important in the Midwest here for us, especially with our cold winters.
Right.
Are there economic benefits associated with biodiesel blends within our state? I know there's some difference in biodiesel costs compared to number two ULSD.
Yeah, so biodiesel is almost always sold at a par or a few cents a gallon cheaper than diesel fuel. So there are federal incentives in place that make biodiesel cost effective. And then there tend to be some local incentives placed both in municipalities and cities and states around the country. But we find our customers throughout Indiana, once again, utilizing biodiesel blends year-round, taking advantage of some of those economic benefits.
That's great. So what are some of the trends you're seeing with public and private fleets in the rest of the country?
Yeah, so I mentioned, Lori, a bit earlier, just I think we're really starting to see a low-carbon emission economy mm-hmm. Developing across the U.S. and it's gathering momentum. So that trend, as a lot of fuel trends, began in the western part of the United States and Canada, and really seems to be gaining traction. I know in some of the upcoming elections, a number of states have initiatives on the ballot pushing these agenda items. So we'll have to see how that goes.
Sure.
And then in addition, in October of this year, Lori, as you know, that the UN issued the report in October of 2018, you know, warning of the dire consequences
yes.
If carbon pollution isn't dramatically reduced in the near term. So I think mm-hmm. that's helping, once again, gain traction and gather momentum. And perhaps in response to that, ExxonMobil actually announced in October as well that they're actually spending $1 million in a lobbying effort to place a tax on planet warming carbon dioxide emissions. So that, in addition to the, you know, the public and private corporate sustainability initiative that I talked about previously, those are all some of the, you know, the big picture trends we're seeing throughout the country, and those will be coming to the Midwest eventually.
Sure. Well, it's good to see people paying attention. John, as we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share with us today?
No, I'd just like to thank, you know, you, Lori, and South Shore Clean Cities and their support of clean energy initiatives, you know, not just biodiesel, but everything that you guys are doing. I would also like to say if people have additional questions about biodiesel, I would encourage them to go to REG's website. It's www.REG.com. REGI.com.
Well, John, we very much appreciate at South Shore Clean Cities having REG as a member and partner and friend. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to John Sherrington, Executive Director of Sales and Marketing for Renewable Energy Group, or REG. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Lori Cagle, in for Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And as Carl says, remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are available online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking. From time to time, we have a chance to chat with Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch about the issues involving the state of Indiana. By the way, if you're not aware, the Lieutenant Governor is the President of the Indiana Senate, and that's going to be one of her jobs that she will take on when the General Assembly returns into session in January. And she's also the Secretary of Agriculture and Rural Development, and she chairs a number of committees within the state and state agencies as well, too. And as always, Lieutenant Governor, thank you for joining us here on Regionally Speaking. Let's get caught up on a few things here. Some big projects we know that you have worked on in the past, and in fact, just recently turned in a final report on, is one that involves helping handicapped folks in Indiana in particular get the kind of help they need and in turn might be even better jobs for them. Tell us a little bit about what the assessment was all about and more about the final report from the task force.
Well, thank you, Chris. Last year, the General Assembly created the Intellectual and Developmental Disability Task Force to look at what the state services and supports are for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Those would be individuals with cerebral palsy, autism, and Down syndrome. There are about 100,000 of them in Indiana. So I chaired that task force. We met all throughout the year in different places in the state, and then we submitted the final report to the Indiana General Assembly at the end of October. It's a 10-year comprehensive report that puts forth those options and those services that we can implement that will provide more choice and quality of life for those individuals. It is so important that every Hoosier have equal opportunity in life. And I always say, Chris, that our friends with disabilities are merely just our friends with different abilities. Mm-hmm. And they have the same dreams and desires as every other Hoosier. They want to have friends and have a job and love and be loved and be successful in life. And this report will hopefully allow them to be more successful. Abraham Lincoln said, the best way to predict your future is to create it. And through this report, we are creating a better future for those individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities throughout Indiana.
Now, I know that during the time that you were gathering information in the task force for the final report, you had a chance to have several meetings around Indiana. What kinds of things do you recall that you all learned from these meetings with the public about the need for putting together everything that should go into this plan, in particular, helping community-based services survive? A lot of those are very important, and that they are the ones, of course, closest to home, but they are sometimes the ones that are oftentimes the most vulnerable to get cut or other changes made.
Throughout the year, we met 10 different times in places throughout the state, several times in Indianapolis. But it was important for us to hear from those people that are the individuals themselves or their family members who are caring for them or providers who are providing those services. So that input was absolutely critical in terms of coming up with a good report. And they were concerned and spoke of many different issues. One is the individuals that are the direct support providers are not paid competitive wage, mm-hmm, compared to other industries. And the Indiana General Assembly increased the amount of reimbursement rate to those individuals in the last budget session. But we're wanting to come back again and in actually lobby for these individuals, these direct service providers, to be able to get an increase in their rate. Because it is so important for those individuals with intellectual developmental disabilities and their family members, to be able to have people that they can depend on and be able to hold, and the providers to be able to hold on to employees that can provide that continuity of service. But in addition to that, also what we heard was from many parents that they want to feel comfortable that when someone comes into their home that there's been some kind of screening, and also those individuals have some uniform statewide certification and training. And so the report also recommends that there be put in place a registrar, and then also that there be some comprehensive statewide training and certification provided for these individuals that are providing the service. We also heard about housing and how important housing is. And through the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority that I chair, we have a number of projects that go out throughout the state that integrate housing in affordable housing for individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities and other disabilities. Mm-hmm. And so we want to increase those opportunities for them. Transportation is another issue that is extremely important to individuals, particularly those in rural areas, that they have to have the means to be able to get to the provider or to get to that place that is providing the therapy that they so desperately need. And so we made recommendations on transportation also. But I can't stress enough how important it was to get that input from the public and from those families that are actually living that life every single day and supporting those individuals who have intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Well, it's great to know that all this information has made it in, and it is in the final report that is now out from the task force. One other point I wanted to check on was, and maybe if there's an update to offer, is about the strategic plan for rural Indiana. That's out of the Indiana Office of Community and Rural Affairs, which I know that you're in charge of. Maybe we should first explain for folks that have just kind of heard about it, what is this strategic plan for rural Indiana all about?
Well, the Office of Community and Rural Affairs is the office that works in distributing community development block grant money to non-entitlement communities. So our smaller communities throughout Indiana, which more often than not are in rural areas. Mm-hmm. So that agency came up with a strategic plan that we released earlier this year on how to develop better our rural Indiana, because 40% of our state's population lives across 76 rural counties, and these rural counties are extremely important to our state and to our economy. For instance, one of the things that they most was a priority for them was expanding broadband in rural Indiana. And Governor Holcomb and I believe that rural Indiana is our next great economic development frontier. But in order for rural Indiana to compete with its more urban centers, those individuals have to have access to fast, affordable, reliable broadband. And that is why we were so encouraged by the Next Level Connections initiative that announced $100 million to be invested in expanding broadband throughout rural Indiana into unserved and underserved areas. Purdue recently did a study, Chris, and said that there are right under 500,000 Hoosiers that are in internet darkness. And if those 500,000 Hoosiers were connected to fast, affordable, reliable broadband, it would result annually in an additional $1 billion to our state's economy. We know that being connected affects every aspect of a Hoosier's life. It affects workforce. It affects health care, education, economic development, and quality of life. And so the ability of Hoosiers to be connected and to have that equal opportunity to succeed throughout Indiana is extremely important. So we are particularly excited about that, and that was a top priority in OCRA's strategic plan.
Mm-hmm. Now, coming ahead in 2019, there's, of course, another General Assembly session, and you get to sit in on the Indiana Senate activities as the President of the Senate. Are there any special things that you are aware of that may come up in either chamber, the House or the Senate, in this upcoming session?
Let me first share, Chris, that as president of the Senate, I was a former state representative for 8 years, and I just always like to share with people that as now as president of the Senate, it's so gratifying to finally be in charge of the Senate.
it's probably in many respects it's like herding cats, you know. That's always a phrase that it's very difficult to handle a group of people like that when you've got all these individuals in one room, though. But a lot of good things can happen, I know, if everybody works together. And we know this next General Assembly session is another budget session, so I'm sure that's going to be top priority, is to try to get the priorities together for spending and yet stay within the realm of a balanced budget.
Absolutely. To stay within the realm of a balanced budget without raising taxes on hardworking Hoosier families. But in addition, they'll be looking at trying to fully fund the budget with revenues that aren't as robust as maybe they've been in past years. So it'll be a challenge, but one certainly that the Indiana General Assembly will be up to. And we will be looking at education funding with K-12 and higher education takes up over half of our budget. I think the last number I saw was those two areas combined take up about over 65% of the total general fund budget. And then when you put in Medicaid, you tack on another 14%. So all the rest will be money that will be looking to be allocated over the other very causes and agencies that serve Indiana and serve Hoosier. So it'll be a challenging year, but one, as I said, that the governor and the Indiana General Assembly will be up to. And I'm confident that at the end of the day, we will have a balanced budget, and we will be able to continue to work on taking Indiana to the next level.
Well, Lieutenant Governor Crouch, thank you very much for what you've talked about today, for the updates, and knowing that the General Assembly has certainly plenty of work to do when they come back into session in January. And we appreciate you spending some of your time to talk with us today about it.
Thank you, Chris, and keep up the good work.
At one time, railroads crisscrossed the state carrying every type of commodity you can imagine, including people. But now the heyday of railroads is long behind us. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright talked with a listener who wanted to know more about what happened.
Indiana native and Bloomington resident Scott Shackelford was curious about the state's old passenger train.
I have had the good fortune to live in some wonderful places that actually are pretty well served by public transit. And I was also just kind of curious why at this day and age we don't have something like that in Indiana. And as I dug more into it, you know, we used to. And I've been curious, you know, why did that go away and what could we do to get it back?
In seeking the answers to Shackelford's question, I ended up in Salem, Indiana, where the Monon Railroad Depot once sat. Now it's a vibrant museum full of Monon artifacts and a massive railway model with immaculate detail in every passenger car and building. It brings Salem, surrounding communities, and the train itself to life. John Campbell is the project director of the model railroad layout.
Well, the layout depicts Washington County, Indiana, and the portion that the Monon Railroad ran through in 1960. We're standing in front of Salem, which is pretty much the midpoint of the county.
The route that later became known as the Monon Railroad got its start in Salem in the 1840s. George Carpenter is the vice president and director of member services for the Monon Railroad Historical Technical Society. He says the train transported all kinds of goods and passengers throughout the state.
The Monon was a completely Indiana railroad. It ran the length of the state from New Albany to Michigan City, with departures out of New Albany to go to Louisville and to go to Chicago.
The Monon reached Bloomington in 1853, following the route of what's now known as the Beeline Trail. The first part of Shackelford's question about why Indiana no longer has a statewide passenger rail line is pretty easy to answer. Carpenter says cars basically drove passenger trains out of business.
Trains were a vital part of our transportation network because roads didn't amount to anything. Roads were often no more than cow paths. They aren't like they are today.
In the 1920s, Indiana had nearly 7,500 miles of railroad tracks. Today, it's about half that number. Large investments have gone toward building and maintaining the state's roads. The Monon stopped transporting passengers in the late 1960s. Shackelford says that doesn't surprise him.
But I hope that we're now kind of coming back around full circle to some of the benefits of this system that we lost.
He's right. There are a lot of benefits, including the ability to work, eat, or sleep. Amtrak operates the Hoosier State Line, which currently takes passengers between Indianapolis and Chicago. But the federal government cut funding for the route in 2013, and funding remains an issue. The train only runs 4 days a week. And as today's generations consider ditching cars and trucks for alternative modes of transportation, an expanded rail line could garner a lot of interest. But I have bad news for Shackelford. Campbell says there really aren't any efforts to bring back a passenger train like the once thriving Monon. He says it's not impossible, but...
Number one, most of the tracks are disappearing, and to not just the cost of rebuilding, the cost of reacquiring right-of-way and then rebuilding couldn't be justified by the ridership.
So now, where IU students and Bloomington residents once loaded into passenger cars, we see walkers, bikers, and runners. Shackelford says that's nice too, but he wishes the state would have done more to preserve what he considers an important part of Indiana's heritage. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
A Whiting native who is a Ball State University student is part of a student team that studied and measured a very historic building in extreme southeast Indiana. And for all that work, has come up with second place in a very important competition. Gwen Stricker is with us to talk about it and about her classes that she's taking at Ball State University. Gwen, thanks for joining us here and recently speaking today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us first about this project in West Harrison, Indiana. That's the community that you all visited to get your information together. Tell us a little bit about what you found about West Harrison, Indiana, and what you were doing down there that got you able to complete the information that you submitted for this competition.
Yeah, so actually one of the people on our team, her family has owned the little schoolhouse for a few generations. So she kind of sparked the idea. We knew that we wanted to compete in the competition. We were kind of searching around areas near Muncie, which is where Ball State is, so that we could find a structure that wasn't actually measured before with the HABS program. So it was kind of difficult to find one that hadn't been already submitted, but that one was a good fit. And it's a small, you know, one-room schoolhouse, one-story. Very simple. It's Italianate in style, and we really just researched it in the context of its history in the Indiana school system. So it's important not only for its architectural style, but also for its inclusion in the Indiana school system.
Now, this building is from 1862, and it's located in West Harrison, Indiana. Tell us about West Harrison and what made it so interesting to visit down there. That's in the neighborhood down by Cincinnati, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we didn't really spend a whole lot of time in the town itself. We basically just stayed on the site at the schoolhouse. But West Harrison, it's part of the larger network of schoolhouses, and this is actually one of the only remaining ones. So that's kind of what made West Harrison important in examining the history of Indiana school systems.
What is it about these schoolhouses that seem to be very interesting? What is it about the design that intrigued you and the other members of the student team?
Well, we thought that it was interesting that even though it was a rather conservative little schoolhouse, they have sort of ways of articulating the facade in a more ornate way. So using bricks and using materials that would have been from local places in a way that kind of made it more special without, you know, breaking the budget.
Now, you got to spend an entire semester working on the information and all the paperwork, I guess, in getting the request in the competition submitted. Tell us more about what kind of work that you've had to do for research from start to finish on this.
Sure. So I was partially involved in the research side of it, but mostly I was involved in the AutoCAD work. So after we measured the building, I went into the AutoCAD program, which is a drafting program that most architectural firms use. And we drafted each facade, the floor plans, a section cut through the building so that you could understand the interior relationship with the exterior. You know, also drawing little details like windows and some of the ornamental features that I was talking about earlier. So that was the bulk of my work. We also compiled a few images that would help to show the condition of the building since it has sat kind of vacant for several years. It's in a little bit of disrepair, but nothing that a little work couldn't help. So that was the bulk of my work, was kind of documenting the current condition of the building.
Now, you had a chance to make the submission to the Charles E. Peterson Prize competition for this year, and you've now come up with, and the rest of the team come up as winning second place in the competition. When did you find out that you made it to second place?
I think we found out in late July. And by that point, you know, I had already moved to New York. I was doing an internship this summer, and then I started at Columbia University in a graduate program. So I, you know, and the prize was awarded at the APTI conference in Buffalo. So I was close enough. Actually, most of the team was able to go and accept that award, which was really great to get everyone back together and be recognized for the work.
I understand that getting this competition prize certainly is well worth it for the monetary value that everybody gets from it. But there's also a very important process that happens, I understand as well, that not only did you do all the work on this particular little schoolhouse, but the drawings that you made and the information that you gathered helps be able to put that work in the Library of Congress. Tell us how the Library of Congress fits into this picture.
Actually, the Department of the Interior, which is a federally run department, they are in charge of most historic preservation work that's at the federal level. And so they oversee the National Register of Historic Places, which is a listing of any place. People can, you know, nominate buildings on their own, and we put together a nomination as well. But it's any place, you know, that you could argue has historic value. So it's listed in the National Register, and then the Library of Congress is what holds the Historic American Building Survey collection. And the Historic American Building Survey started in the 1930s. It was a program to help document U.S. historic properties at the time, and it's continued since it started then. And Charles E. Peterson was the person who started that, so that's why the prize is named after him.
Well, the Library of Congress, with all this information that they will have in their archives and all, it probably would help if they have to do work on the building or actually reconstruct the building if something happened to it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so if the building ever were to be damaged or destroyed, the drawings would definitely help. They're not construction drawings, so you couldn't just hand them off to, you know, someone and say, build this building, but they could definitely help someone to understand what the building was like, what it was constructed of, things like that. So it's important information, you know, to be archived, because if the building ever were to be lost, there's at least some sort of record of it and why it was important.
We're talking with Gwen Stricker from Whiting. She has been a Ball State student in architecture, and that's one of the things we want to find out more about here now. Tell us what kind of experience that you managed to pick up from being on the team and in this competition as far as wanting to be an architect.
The most I learned from this competition was really about observing, you know, historic buildings and being able to measure those buildings at the same time. We learned a lot of technical skills in terms of going and measuring, making, you know, measured sketches out in the field that could then be translated into computer drafting drawings. So that was really helpful, especially this summer when I was interning at a preservation architecture firm in New York. I had already, you know, gone through the process and had a background knowledge of that, so it really helped me to be able to complete that sort of work and contribute to that firm. And it's helping me now that I'm in my graduate study in historic preservation.
Do you find that that overall that the experiences that you had in classes, as well as any other work that you did while you were getting your undergrad degree in architecture at Ball State, has helped out? Certainly getting you into the graduate school at Columbia University.
Yeah, I think it helped a lot. I enjoyed a lot of my classes, and I think that the nice thing about Ball State's architecture program is that you can also minor in historic preservation, so you can, you know, focus on classes that are more in tune with historic buildings as opposed to contemporary design. So I have a sort of design background, but I also was able to focus on historic buildings even while I was an undergrad, which is super helpful in getting me into Columbia, because a lot of people, you know, when they come into a historic preservation program, they may not have any prior experience with historic preservation or historic buildings at all. Yeah. So that's a real strength with the Ball State program.
Well, Gwen, thanks for being with us to talk about your experiences, your work on the student team, and congratulations to you and all your colleagues that were a part of the student team from Ball State University working on this competition, the Charles E. Peterson Prize Competition, which you and the team members have picked up second place in. And thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you.
Gwen Stricker's a native of Whiting. She's a Ball State University now graduate, and she's taking graduate studies at Columbia University in New York. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us now in the studio to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, is it okay if I brag just a little? I've been doing quite a lot of wishing this past week, and like a canine miracle, my wish was granted. Little Sticky Fingers is coming home for Thanksgiving dinner. Sticky Fingers is a tiny girl child human. When she was 2 years old, she dropped all of her food on the floor. Now she's 3, and I hope she still does that, because I know then just where to sit on Thanksgiving Day, and that would be directly under her seat. This year, she'll be at the adult table with real adults who are eating some very serious Thanksgiving dinner, which includes turkey, and much more turkey. I don't care if it's roasted, basted, fried, or barbecued, as long as it's turkey. I look for a boneless and well-cooked nibble. Welcome to Thanksgiving dinner, little Sticky Fingers. I have staked out my spot, and it's not under my pet parents' seats. Why not, you ask? Because they run all the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, we know it as ASPCA, stuff that comes in the mail, and small useless address labels with them. My man-human never drops food and never, never feeds us dogs under the table. The ASPA says that's a no-no. My woman-human always reads everything they send but makes many exceptions and sometimes will slip me something because it is, after all, a holiday to be thankful for. I expect that since she carefully read the Thanksgiving safety tips, the turkey won't be undercooked because that may contain salmonella bacteria. She won't give us stuffing because it might contain sage or other herbs that are containing essential oils and resins that can cause gastrointestinal upset and central nervous system depression to pets if eaten in large quantities. Cats are not usually under the table, but they are especially sensitive to sage, and I'm happy that no cats live here. In the kitchen, when there are baking and cooking activities, she won't give me raw dough because if ingested, the animal's body heat can cause the dough to rise in his stomach. That is so weird. As it expands, I might experience vomiting and certainly bloating, which might become life-threatening. Well, I've never risen, so to speak, so I really don't want that experience. Holiday cakes are off the menu, too, because if the cake includes raw eggs, they could contain salmonella bacteria that may lead to food poisoning. With all that bad stuff behind us, I'm still taking a chance on Sticky Fingers. Poached under her seat, she'll be the best spot to enjoy Thanksgiving Day, and the turkey will be all mine. Signed, Bruno, Labrador Border Collie Mix, Lowell, Indiana.
So, Bruno, was there a question in your letter? I didn't think so. Therefore, without a question, there is no answer. Instead, I send to you and all of my listeners fond remembrances, heartfelt appreciation, and warm thoughts for a fabulous holiday. May every dog that reads this column have their very own Sticky Fingers eating dinner at their home on Thanksgiving Day. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie. And remember, love. is a four-legged word.
If you have a question for your friend in Ferrali, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. We're off for Thanksgiving Day, so we'll be back on Monday.